Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. At the end of the previous episode, Colonel Norman Gattis had just been shot down over North Vietnam and captured by enemy soldiers. Here's part two of my interview.
So I just surrendered. I waited there for probably 2 hours, and then a small pickup truck came along with two guards, and they took me into Hanoi from that point on.
Did you immediately go to the Hanoi Hilton?
No, we stopped at a very nice house up there. I was amazed. It was a large house, beautiful lawn, and didn't have any signs or anything like that on it, and waited for perhaps 10 minutes, and a young Vietnamese man came out, well-dressed, had on shoes, and which was a bit unusual. You know, they usually wear clogs. And he had on a nice pair of pants and a nice shirt. And he had my ID card, and he said, "What is your name?" And I said, "My name is Norman Gattis, Colonel, United States Air Force." And he had my ID card, and he said, "Thank you." And he went in. So the driver took off, and 2 hours later, we landed. We entered a large building, large enclosure, and they took me then out of that and began to talk to me. And from then, they put handcuffs on me and took me to the Hanoi Hilton. That's where I ended up. Must have been about close to 10 o'clock at night.
Tell me about that place.
They were not very friendly. they were not at all friendly. And
did you assume you'd be tortured?
I assumed that I would be tortured for information. When they recognized that I was a full colonel and a senior officer, they probably said, "We think you have information that would be of value." And so I never had any thoughts about them killing me at that point in time. It wasn't until after I really got in to the business and I would only give them my name, rank, and serial number that they got angry about that.
What did they do when they got angry?
Beat you over the head with your fists and everything else, and they didn't want to, beat me up too badly, but they worked me over.
Did you think that you were going to go into one of those sessions and you were not going to come out alive? They were just going to beat you to death at one point?
I thought that they probably were going to kill me, and I was still outside of this big building that I thought was the Hanoi Hilton. But it turned out that after 30 minutes there, several people came out to look at me, of course, and it was totally dark at that point in time. And a girl was outside of the truck, and she lifted up the canvas, and she had a flashlight that was about this long, and she started working over my head with that, whopping me with that flashlight. And finally, a couple of the guards caught her and said, you know, no, 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 no. So after that, they took me then to the Wallo prison. And once I went inside, it was cut and dried from that point on that, you know, they were going to get information from me. And so for the next probably 72 hours, I was, most of the time, I was unconscious or incoherent. I couldn't answer their questions and things. I wanted a drink of water, and I asked them, please, may I have a drink of water? And in just a little while, an older lady, and she must have been chewing tobacco or snuff, had it all down her mouth. She brought me in a glass of water. Not ice water, but just water. And I thanked her for it. And I think that more or less, I think, helped me in a certain extent that I was kind to her and for bringing me that water. And so torture went on for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours.
Lots of pain.
Yes, lots of torture, lots of torture. And I told them I am supposed to give you my name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. And they said, no, more. And they had these handcuffs that just put on, and they tightened them down until my hands turned black, my feet turned black. They tore all the skin off here down along the ankles. And they never did break the skin here, but my hands were black even after they took me out of the handcuffs. It was about 3 weeks before my hands came back to a normal color. And
what sort of training did the Air Force give you in trying to survive the torture?
Well, they didn't. You know, you had the code of conduct for officers, for all people. And I followed the code of conduct, hoping that that would satisfy them, but it didn't. Of course, they continued to hit me with fan belts, and also I don't think there was any sticks involved in it that time, but most of it was using a fan belt that was about this long that had been cut, and they beat my shoulders, my head with that, and tried to I asked for water in there, and they actually gave me some water. But then they turned around, started beating again.
Did you ever get to a breaking point?
No. No. I never.
Okay.
I never.
What in your past prepared you for this moment?
Well, I had gone through a survival training course, and that is part of the training. You know, what you can or cannot do. You can try to deceive them if you think that deception will work. You can try whatever you like, but...
But what in your life, what... I think most people really cannot conceive how tough this was, how painful this was, how emotionally draining this was. Yeah. How in the world did you survive that without quitting?
I just simply said, you know, that I have agreed to serve, and I will do my best, and I will protect every bit of information that I can do. And if they kill me, then they kill me.
Well, you had a resignation about that if that's what it takes.
Yes, that I was not going to cave in. I was not going to cave in. And I went through terrible, terrible torture with these, particularly with these cuffs. And it finally, it was 3 weeks before I could, when they took those off, hold a glass of water in my hand. I mean, the hands just drooped this way. I couldn't wash myself. I smelled like a goat and with feces all over it. And it was just absolutely unbearable.
How much of it was the humiliation, the fact that they're trying to break you down from a psychological standpoint?
I had gone through 2 different classes on survival, and I had been told that that's the way they're going to treat you. You can expect that, but the code of conduct tells you that, you know, that I will only give my name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. And that's what I tried to do, and that's what I did. That's all I gave them.
Tell me about that place. What was it like?
Miserable. Miserable, miserable.
Tell me about your cell.
They they left me in the torture room. I'm trying to recall the number of hours. Well, it was sometime the next morning that they finally allowed me. I told them.
Was it 64 hours?
It was. I don't know just how many hours it was, but they finally let me go to an area where I could urinate. Well, there wasn't any way that I could use my hand. So I just urinated all over my clothes and everything else. They had 2 pieces of old tire shaped, just like these things are shaped, and they had a strap across them, pretty much. I don't know why I wore these things, but that's what they had. And of course, I urinated all over those things. But there no food, no, I didn't have to use the restroom. I didn't have a bowel movement, I think, for about 3 or 4 days. And that came simply as a result of having a bowl of soup that had some spaghetti-like in there. That's what they fed me while I was in there in the interrogation. And so I was weak, very, very weak, and just dragging. When they finally, when they finally took me out of that interrogation room and dropped me in a cell, I could not get off of the floor. I slept on the floor, and big rats ran over me. And I thought, well, those guys are going to have a hard time eating this. But I couldn't get up. I laid there for I don't know how many hours. And it was daylight the next day before I could get myself up out of the floor. And then when they came in with the food, they put the food on the benches. They had a bench on this side, a bench on this side. The room was about 7 feet square. It's about like this right here with the bed over there and a bed over here. And then here on each end, they had leg irons built into the concrete beds. And there was nothing comfortable about that. But the rats didn't eat on me that night. Thank goodness they didn't. I can recall being there. And one of the things that I remembered being in there, I heard some American music that was coming from a building outside of the prison, to the north of the prison. Let me see that package right there. Right there. Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, this this is the prison. Right here. And to the north of the prison, they had some high apartments. And while I was in there that night, I heard American music coming from.
Now, was that reassuring or was it haunting?
I believe it was American music. I believe that it was American music.
But what I'm saying, did that reassure you or did it, was it making it worse?
Well, I thought this is very unusual. That there might be someone up there that spoke English and understood that, but it was so strange that here in the, you know, when, and everything at night, there's very little traffic in the streets there at night, there was then. And at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, to hear this American music was a little bit unusual.
Do you remember what song it was?
No, I don't have any idea.
It was rock and roll music?
Yeah, it was American music. Yeah. And I often, when I would get out, I would look up there to see if I could see anything that I thought where there might be apartments up there where people were living. But I talked to the other people that were in the in that particular area with me, and they said, you know, we have never heard that. We don't know. We've never heard anything coming from there.
Tell me about some of your comrades.
Two people who lived with me, we lived together. One was Colonel John Flynn. He was our senior officer. I had known him for many years. I knew him when both of us were stationed in England back in 1956. And Colonel David Wynn, W-I-N-N, he was there. The third person who was there was, and he didn't show up until sometime later, and that's another story. But they put the three of us together three senior colonels together, and we were in this small room. And so we'd take turn about sleeping, and they finally did move us to a larger area. But then they brought in another full colonel by the name of Bean, Jim Bean. Jim's airplane had been hit by a missile, and he was severely burned from his neck down to his buttocks.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for more conversation.
How did you occupy your days when they weren't torturing you?
Trying to relive trips that I had been on, places that I had seen, things that were unusual in the way of cars and airplanes and homes. I always thought about, you know, well, the time will come when I get out of here, I'm going to build a house. And, you know, if I built this house, what would it look like? So in just mentally to think about a house, something that your wife would approve of, and I just kept my mind active about that. Also, I thought about trips that I had taken with my family, the things that we had done together, the wonderful things that happened when you have children and grandchildren. And that was an inspiration to me. I got my first letter from my wife 2.5 years after I was shot down. They destroyed all of the others. They wouldn't give them to me. So,
what did that feel like, holding that letter in your hands?
Well, it was a shot in the arm, I'll tell you. It was really, really wonderful, you know, just to know. I knew that my wife had some female problems and that she was not well when I left home. And this letter was just like the letters that you would get as a POW. They would let her only write about 6 lines. You know, in a small thing like this. And so I would try to read between the lines on things that she was telling me. And of course she let me know that her mother and her father died while I was there, and that other family members had died. Like she would say, you know, I sure miss John. That was telling me that John had passed away.
What was worse, the torture that they put you through, the physical torture they put you through, or the separation and the pain of the separation from your family?
Well, I'd say the separation from the families. I even told the commander up there this is not right. You should allow us to have the information that comes from our families. We shouldn't have to wait 2.5 years to get a letter or something like this. And of course, he didn't comment on it. He was, some told me that he had a position in the colleges. They heard that he had position in a college, and but he was a decent sort of person after the war ended. He got us all together, and they released the first group of people, and he came to me with hands full of money, green money. And I knew where it came from. It came from pilots. I happened to be one of them that was carrying some green money. So they took it. They held on to the money, and he came and brought it to me. And so I said to him, you know, we would really like to have some fruit. Would you take this money and buy some fruit for us? And he did. I mean, every morning until the last American left up there, they had fruit from out in the market that he brought in. And I did this, you know, not angry at him or anything else. I just said, we would really like to have some fruit. It would help us with our weight. We'll look better.
How much weight did you lose when you were there?
I normally weighed at about 155 pounds, and I had the chance one time to weigh myself, and I weighed 122. So that was about my weight for the time I was up there.
Did you ever give up hope thinking, I'm never getting out of here alive?
No. I wouldn't do that. I just absolutely would not allow myself to think that way.
Where does that come from?
Well, it's just the desire to live. And I told him, and he in one of his, this is the commander, you know, he told me, you will never go home. You will never go home. And I looked him straight in the eye and I said, yes, I will. I will go home. I will go home.
Did you allow yourself to hate him?
Right.
Did you hate him?
No, did I hate him?
Yeah.
I didn't. No, I won't say I hated him. All I could say was that, you know, and this came about between the time they made the announcement that we were going to be released. Then we fell into groups. The first group would leave, and I was in the second group. And so I knew that I would get out of there, eventually get out of there. After the first group left, he came to the window, and this meant put on your striped suit. So I put on my striped suit, and a guard took me to his office, and he said, sit down. First time he'd ever asked me to sit down. And he said, do you think you will ever come back to visit us? And I looked him in the eye and I said, no, I won't. You haven't treated us as prisoners of war, and you were supposed to treat us as prisoners of war. So I won't be back to visit with you. And 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, from this prison over there, a group of the young fighter pilots got together with an American who lives in South Carolina. My picture is, three pictures of me are in here somewhere, in this place. And
how does that make you feel?
Well, I learned about this one about 3 years ago. Two friends of mine from over in Bermuda Run, which is to the west of Winston-Salem, they called me and said, what are you doing today? Nothing. They said, well, let's have lunch together. I have something I want to show you. And okay, what? So we got together and had lunch, and so they broke this out, and they said, now, said, you see, there's three pictures in here, one here, one here, and one right over there. One of those pictures is you. That's your picture. The other...
At the Hanoi Hilton.
At the Hanoi Hilton.
The place where you were tortured.
Right. The second guy is John McCain. The third picture is Pete Peterson. Pete Peterson was the first U.S. ambassador to serve in Vietnam. So that's what these guys were telling me. And he said they would like very much for you to come back to visit them. And I told them that the camp commander also asked me that question before I was released. He said, will you ever come back to visit us? And I said, no, no. You have treated us like animals. If you had treated us as military people, and that's the way we treated your people, if you had treated me as a military person, then I would come back. But you didn't. You treated us like animals, and so I won't be back to see you. And I was not angry with him. I just laid it on the line, you know, that if things had been different, I would be back.
How did you, when you came back, how did you deal with the pain of all that, the lingering pain?
Well, the one thing that I decided to do, and once I got home and things kind of settled down, I talked to my wife and I said, you know, after I have answered all your questions, the questions that you would like to, you know, have information on, like, did you get this letter from me telling me that so-and-so had passed away or so-and-so had married or that there were new children and things like this? I said, after all of that, I appreciate everything that you've done, you know, as a wife, and just hope that nothing like this would ever happen to us again. But I had put forth all of the effort that I could put forth. I said, and I kept telling this guy who was in charge here, you know, he'd say, you're never going home. And I would look him in the eye and say, yes, the time will come when I will go home. I will go home. And I never doubted that I wouldn't get out of there. So I had the confidence that our people were eventually going to get off of their rear ends and get us out of there, and they did. And so,
when you got on that airplane and you came back to the States, what's going through your mind?
Well, you know what?
Because after all, and you were in captivity for more than 5 years.
Yes, almost six. Almost six. Well, I knew that there had been a lot of changes. I knew that some of my wife's, her parents had passed away, and through just a message that she would send, I read between the lines that they had passed away. And this kind of thing, she never came directly out and said, because of course the Vietnamese were reading all of the letters and things, and she she would let me know as much as possible of what was going on. But I didn't get the first letter until at least 2.5 years, maybe 3 years, before they let me have the first letter, and then they took it right back. As soon as I read it, they took it back and would never let me see it again.
So when you came home and you started working at the Pentagon, you continue your Air Force career?
Yes.
You eventually become a general? How did you deal with the lingering effects of what happened to you in captivity? Were you haunted by it?
I came back. I always hoped that I would have a chance to come back and finish an Air Force career. I looked forward to it, and I just kept hoping against hope that medically I would meet the qualifications so that I could that I could stay in the Air Force. That I would like to do. I'd like to stay until I finish. I didn't set myself a goal that, no, I want to be a general. No, I didn't do that. I wouldn't even think about that. My thoughts were about my family and trying to make certain that I could hold my, that we, my wife and I, could do the things that would hold our family together. And we were able to do that. That was really my goal. And of course, I did learn that some of my other relatives had passed away, and I knew that there'd be a great deal of sadness with that. There's just like her mother and father passing away, and that she was there by herself too, because her brother was still alive at that time, and her sister was still alive. So she had some comfort in knowing that she had part of her family who were still with her, and she could go and talk to them at any time about my situation in Vietnam and what might happen. You know, when will he be released? What will he be like when he comes back? And of course, no one knew the answer to those questions.
What were you like when you came back?
I was a happy as I was the happiest colonel you ever saw in your life. it was just hard to explain that, you know, after all of these years, 2,124 days, that now I was going to be able soon to see my family. And I had complete confidence in her ability to hold the family together on her side. You know, her sister did one of her, her brother-in-law, not her sister, but her family, they were all together, and you know, nothing happened to them. Nothing major happened to them. And so she could look and tell me, but there were things that happened. Some of our friends who passed away, we spent hours after I got home, she's telling me about different ones of the family who had passed away and the circumstances and so forth. And we were grateful that it turned out that I was able to come back I had missed a lot of what had gone on in society for that period of time, but the Air Force was kind enough to take us down to Montgomery, and for about 3 or 4 days, they covered factual information that had happened over a period of 6 and 7 years.
Did that blow your mind?
It did.
But you're talking about 1967 to 1973.
Right.
The world had changed.
Oh, yes. And
And how did it feel for you to find out that there were not only people burning their draft cards and protesting in the streets against the war, but they were spitting on returning servicemen?
Well, I don't know that anyone ever spit on me. I know a lot of people wanted to shake hands with me. They wanted to say hello, and I was grateful for all of that, every bit of it. And I just thank God for the fact that she, along with her friends and along with her church, had not forgotten me or all of us. You know, it was not just me as a prisoner, but it was for all of those prisoners over there, that they held special programs and they had special events for the families.
You know, there was one of the things was that there was a movement in the early 70s about people wearing bracelets.
Oh, yes.
And one of my friends had a bracelet with your name on it.
Uh-huh, yes.
And that, how did that make you feel when you heard about that when you came back?
Well, it brought tears to my eyes. And my wife said, well, let me tell you, said, I have been selling bracelets, and in our closet back at the house, you are going to have to help me because we still have bracelets. But I said, I sold thousands of them. I sold thousands of them. And just to tell you that 2 days ago, I sent a bracelet to a young lady who was, her parents were stationed with us in Germany in 1949. She was born there in 1950, and so I was one of her godparents. She said, what is this about bracelets? And I told her, and she said, oh my, your name is on a bracelet? And I said, my wife sold thousands of those bracelets. And I think that I still have a bracelet. And she said, would you give me that bracelet? And I said, you bet your bottom dollar I will. And so I sent it to her last week. And I could almost, when she called me, I could almost hear it without the phone. She lives down in Texas, and she was so happy to get that bracelet. She said, I put it on, and I'm going to keep it on there. When I die, it'll still be on there. But that was tremendous stories that came from those bracelets. Golly. And we tried to meet and talk to as many people as we could probably talk to and to thank them personally, you know, for their activities, the people who had helped with the bracelets, the people who had taken part in all of the things that the wives were involved in. And it was just, it made you feel good to know that, hey, these people, even though we were miles apart, they had not forgotten us. And it was encouraging, really encouraging. And so I don't know where I'm going to get another bracelet. I sent my last one to her, and she was just absolutely, absolutely astounded by that.
What advice would you give to a young person today who wants to lead a meaningful life?
It's a difficult question. Let's don't give up the idea that America is still a great country. And it can,
what does America mean to you?
Well, it means to me that we can live in peace with one another, and we can do many, many things to help one another. All of us have problems from different things that have happened to us, and we need help. We need to help one another. We need to help those people who are down and out. what can we do to get those people off the street? Can we educate them? Can we give fine jobs that they could fit into jobs and things like this? What can we do as individuals to help? And that would be one of the things. I would think that if I saw a person on the street, I'd want to stop, and they were hungry, I'd want to stop and feed them, let them know that I care about them, let them know that perhaps there is a place that they could earn some money, that they could read, they could help themselves and become better citizens and so forth. But it seems that we're fighting among ourselves.
If you could go back to that young man who decided to ask if he could become a pilot, and knowing that it was going to lead you to all of this joy, but also all of this pain, what would you tell him?
I would say to them that, yes, I want you to do. I want you to do your best. Do everything you can to make yourself a pilot. And as a pilot, then you will have a lot of responsibility looking after people, looking after families, and it is an opportunity for you to express some gratitude to people who, over the years, have helped this country grow and become what it is today. So you're just part of that. Your work, your help, your ideas can make this even a better country.
Thanks to Lane McGivney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life, and audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You too can become an American Achiever.